You're listening to the New World Order, episode 376. We have finished the M as in life section from the AP package set of Slackware, and are beginning the N as in November section today in this very episode. If you're new to the show, or you've just completely forgotten what the show is about, we go through, or rather I should say lately we've been going through, every single package installed on a Slackware install process, Slackware Linux install. I should probably mention from time to time, just for people who kind of who've come into the show recently, this isn't actually what the show is. And this is not a show dedicated to just talking about the packages that get installed on Slackware Linux. It's normally just me talking about whatever Linux topic I wanted to talk about. It just so happens that about a year ago, I got it into my head that I should talk about every single package installed by default on Slackware, and that's what we've been doing ever since. But when I'm finished with Slackware, like all the packages on Slackware, when we reach that final package set, the show will go back to its sort of normal format of just me talking whatever happens to be on the line. And frankly, I mean, you've probably seen a little bit of that already, because sometimes I do deviate a little bit from the topic. I just wanted to kind of make that clear for people who are kind of new-ish to the show. And in this episode, we're going to start out with a little bit of listener email, in fact. So let's look at this email from James, or Jim, as his friends call him, I assume. And he says that MC was written by, at least originally, was written by Miguel de Casa, who you may or may not know from as the creator or the progenitor of the GNOME desktop very early on. Of course, it's been taken over by other people now, but also the Mono project, which is the open source re-implementation of the .NET project, which was started before .NET became open source itself. That's why that exists. Okay, so that's kind of interesting to know about, I guess. It was created in 1994. Midnight Commander was kind of interesting. Let's see. So the last podcast, I kept saying the term MPEG-3, which is a weird mistake for me to make, because I'm quite aware, actually, that there is no MPEG-3. There was an MPEG-2 and then MPEG-4, and MPEG-3 was skipped over. MP3, of course, is actually MPEG-2 audio transport layer 3, as James points out. So I'm not entirely sure why I made that error, especially since MP3 and MPEG-3 are the same number of syllables, so it's not as if, though, I was just trying to shorten it. Very strange. I think I was just probably too busy complaining about MPEG in general to get the naming conventions correct, which was kind of silly of me, but thanks, James, for the correction and the clarification. And then James closes the email saying that he may have used Norton Commander briefly back in his DOS and Windows days. He doesn't seem positive that that was a thing for him, but he does remember something called Directory Opus on his Amigas. It was a two-panel file mover that had preview modes for media files, so you could see if the, for instance, Billy picture was the same picture as Billy 123. It helped with deduping drives back when they measured drives in megabytes. A single picture could easily use like 2% of that 80 megabyte primary hard drive. And this was the interesting part for me of this email, to be honest, because these little software applications, these little applications that existed back in the, let's call it, 80s and 90s, I feel like is the region of time that I'm talking about, give or take. But there were these little applications, you know, if you go far back enough, there was a thing called shareware and I don't know, other things like postcardware and, you know, all, sort of any prefix followed by WARE. But I feel like there's a certain nostalgia for that for a computer user who was around at all at that time, or had around and had a computer, either a computer user in their home or had a computer in their home. And even that statement right there is a little bit weird, you know, to qualify, oh, well, you would have had to been around at that time and you would have had to have a computer. No one's ever going to say that about someone living in, I don't know, 2010 onward, maybe. Like, you're not going to, I mean, well, certainly 2010 for computers, but I'm even thinking of just like a mobile device, 2010 onwards. No one's going to ever say, well, you would have had to have been alive in 2015 and you would have had to have a computer or a cell phone. Yeah, it's a given, right? So it's so funny that in just as recent as the 1980s, we have to qualify what group of people some computer specific memory can apply to. So if you were around back then, you didn't have to be very old, you just had to know someone with a computer, then you may have memories of these little bits of software that just kind of popped up in one form or another, whether you're old enough to remember them, like on floppy disks at a vintage, not a vintage, computer store. At that time, they would have just been a computer store. You wouldn't have called it a vintage computer store. It was the future, the computer store, or whether it's something that, you know, someone downloaded from a BBS or however they appear. There were little bits of software out there just kind of appearing all over the place. I mean, people programmed them. They didn't just literally just appear, but I mean, they cropped up. People programmed them and put them on a disk or put them on a server or whatever BBS is run off of. I guess it must have been some kind of server. Anyway, by definition, it would be a server. So you put the thing on some media and you send it out into the world and people use it. And a lot of those people, like people who wrote that software, like this one, Directory Opus for the Amiga, they'll never know that James was a user of Directory Opus. They don't know that he loved Directory Opus. I mean, I don't know that he loved it either. He didn't say he loved it. He just said he did use it. But let's pretend for a moment that James loved Directory Opus. It was a game changer. I mean, it allowed him to preview his media files. That was huge probably at that time. And so you have this little software thing that probably James and, you know, all, I don't know, 200 other Amiga users or 200,000. I don't know how popular Amigas were compared to anything else, but some subset of computer users who were Amiga users and who used Directory Opus, those are the people who had that experience. Nobody else does. Nobody else can say, oh yeah, I used to use Directory Opus on the Amiga. And there's something about that. There's something about that almost, if I'm not over-romanticizing it, sort of the privilege of being able to be someone to experience that along with other people and the developer of the software. That's something that none of us, you and me, dear listener, we can't go back and experience that. We could maybe get an Amiga, a vintage Amiga, or we could run, what is it, RISC OS? I think that's what it's called. They really just call it RISC OS after the architecture? That's weird. But we could get, you know, like a re-implementation of the Amiga software, or do you even have to do that? Maybe the Amiga thing, maybe that, I think that might still actually be produced. I think that's actually a thing. I think you can go to, AmigaOS.net. So you could do this. You can make this happen. You can go purchase Amiga OS, apparently. It's not open source, so don't get too excited about this. And run the Amiga operating system, I guess, and maybe find a copy of Directory Opus and so on. So we can capture the spirit of it, but we cannot actually experience it at the time. And I think, I guess this is the realization, the culmination of the fear of missing out. Right, that is exactly what people are talking about when they say, I don't want to miss out on something. That's what, if you look back at shareware or whatever else kind of ware, freeware, whatever they called it back then, we missed out on that, or some of us did. I mean, James didn't. He was there. He did it. Other people weren't there, weren't at the same place, and so we have missed out on that, and that's fascinating to me. And I feel the same kind of sort of sense of loss or something or whatever when I think back at early Linux. Even though deep down I know that I would never have survived in the early Linux world. Maybe I would if I'd been like at a different, like if I was where I am now and Linux was just appearing, I think then yes, I could have survived early Linux if early Linux was just now. But true early Linux and where I was in my life and my understanding of computers and my interest in computers and so on, it just wouldn't have worked. And I'm really, you know, technically quite happy that I missed out on early Linux, because number one, I think it probably would have spoiled me in a bad way. You know, it kind of would have put me off of Linux. I would have thought, okay, this is stupid. I'll never look at this again. So I think that would have been a real danger. And also I feel like I would have probably, if I'd stuck with it, I would have spent a lot of time on it, and that I don't think I would have gotten what I needed at the time. Cause I think I would have had to adjust a lot of things in life. So, you know, it would be like, it would spawn a completely different timeline essentially for my life. And it would be a lot different, probably a lot better, frankly, but that's not how it happened. But it's really cool that that experience exists back in time and out there, and people have had those experiences. And it's just something that I urgently feel kind of the need to hear and capture the stories of. And I don't know, you know, I don't know, maybe at some point, who knows, maybe I'll bug all of you, probably, if you're listening to this, maybe I'll bug you for your story, for your retro computer story, and then compile it into a book or something and put it on Smashwords and take all the profits and become rich with all the three people who purchased the book. And that's, it's just like this computer history, I guess, which normally I don't technically care about. I don't think it's the hardware that I really care about all that much. I mean, I do have a healthy respect for it. You know, when I see an old computer, I often do think, oh, that is very cool to see what computers looked like back at that time and to imagine what it would be like to use that particular computer. But frankly, the hardware is not really that exciting to me because I have very few memories of what it was like to use that hardware because I just wasn't that into computers. And when I look at it, I just see it doesn't run, or it wasn't running Linux at the time, and that really kind of kills my interest. If it's retro hardware, like a Sun Microsystem or something, okay, that's a little bit more intriguing to me. That's interesting. But just a 486, a 58, was there a 586? I don't even know. Were there computers that were called 586s? I know there's an architecture 586, but was that a computer? Could you go and say, hey, I want to buy a 586? Because I know you could do that, I think, for a 486 and a 286 or something like that. See, I don't know what I'm talking about. Point is, what really interests me, I think, are the experiences of the people relating to everything, but particularly software, very frequently software. Now, the important thing here, that the actual takeaway that I'm trying to get to here, is that I feel like open source is successfully recapturing that event, that happening, that sensation of discovery, if you let it. And I think it's a huge, great, neat, big deal that you can actually use open source as more or less a mindless drone and just fall into stuff. Like, you can get into open source today and use all of the obvious applications and never sort of realize that there are hundreds and thousands of other software application options out there for you that you could be using instead. You could absolutely pick up an ISO image of your favorite distribution, and if you don't have one, then it could be someone else's favorite distribution, you know, just the person you met who told you about Linux, and you decided to emulate them. You thought, well, they seem smart on computers. I want to be that smart. I'm going to use what they're using. So you download FUBAR Linux and run it, and you just use whatever they have in their repository. You use whatever they provide you on the desktop. Maybe you probably find a couple of neat little discoveries in whatever app store is offered to you. But generally speaking, you find the really, really obvious replacements for the thing that you did on your other computer, and that's kind of your life. And even when you start branching out and you start going into some other unexpected direction because of the freedom that open source has afforded you, even then, you're going in obvious directions. You know, you look at, if you decide to go into music making, you look at Ardour Nothing wrong with Ardor. You look at LMMS, nothing wrong with LMMS. But you never look at non, N-O-N. You never look at AJ snapshot for your Jack session snapshots, that sort of thing. You never find those little ones because you're using, there is enough hype, I guess, around the obvious ones. And it's great. That's so exciting that open source is in that place where there are obvious options. That's, I think, really, really huge. It's strangely huge that that's a big deal. Because what that means is that if I'm saying there are obvious options, I think that that's a lot different than saying, well, they're the only options. It's super satisfying to be able to say, oh yeah, well, this is the obvious choice for music production, but there are, five other ones that you could be using too. But this is the one that everyone goes with. It's really important. I mean, you can't say that for everything all the time. Sometimes there are just the obvious, like the obvious one is the only one, practically. So the fact that there are lots and lots of options out there, that's a healthy place to be. And it's great that people can get into open source and not deviate from those projects. And I think this feeling, this desire manifests itself, especially in new users. And I know this was true for me, where, and I've talked about this before, where people look at open source at the whole big messy community that open source is and says, well, you'd get so much farther along if you would all just choose one thing and work on it together. And let's say there's a I don't know, an image editor, and people say, well, why are you doing this? That you're just re-implementing GIMP. Why don't you just work on GIMP? Or there's a video editor, and they say, well, why are you working on this video editor? Why don't you just go contribute to this other one? They are already so far along. Why don't you just work on that? So there's this desire to focus and kind of organize and consolidate effort. But I think what the way that it actually happens, because ideally that won't happen. We don't actually want that. We think we want that sometimes. Like I say, especially when we're new to Linux, very excited about it. We just want good things to happen real quick. It just seems like, well, let's just all focus everything into laser beam precision and make this thing great. And that does sound really cool. It's just, unfortunately, it isn't exactly how software is developed. It's not quite how it works. But I think what does happen is, over time, things do get the attention that they need. They do get the support that they need. They get the usage that they need. And those things start to, as the cliche goes, rise to the top. Brilliant. That's what we want. We want those things to get really good, to be well supported, for people to trust them. That's exactly the kind of that's what we're after. But the other side to that is that there needs to be the little projects that probably aren't great for everyone, frankly. Maybe they're just too limited in scope. Maybe they're a little bit broken here and there, but if you don't use that one feature, then you're okay. Maybe they're hyper-specific. Maybe they're hastily made. Maybe they're not maintained anymore, and you kind of have to go in and update some of the code yourself in order for it to build. Whatever the thing about it is that makes it not suitable for everybody, for the people who are okay with that, then it may very well make it the perfect tool for somebody or for some set of people. And I think that's the spiritual successor to this idea of there being quirky little sharewares that pop up that probably don't last all that long in terms of maintenance and so on. Quirky little freeware applications that you get from the, have a floppy, give a floppy, need a floppy, take a floppy jar. It's just, I don't know, like wherever you got freeware, these applications, these small little applications that you use and no one else even within your open source community, wherever that is, they've never heard of it, or they wouldn't touch it. They don't need it. And maybe for some people that's Midnight Commander, which is how we got onto this topic in the first place. Maybe for other people it's Password Store, the terminal-based password manager for Linux. Maybe for other people it's, I don't know, Credit, a encrypted text editor that I wrote to interface with GNU-PG so that all of your notes are encrypted, but once you open them in the editor, it pipes it through GNU-PG, stores it in temporary file storage, lets you edit it and then saves it back to an encrypted file. Or maybe it's something that you wrote. Maybe it's one of those custom little scripts, which, I mean, that's all credit really is for me. Maybe it's one of those custom little scripts that you got on your hard drive and have had it there for the past 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 13 years. Who knows? It's there. You use it, and that's your experience. And when you look back in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, that's going to be part of that experience. It's going to be part of the history of you on Linux back in the old 2020s or whatever. So, yeah, it's kind of cool. And I think it's important to kind of keep that in mind and to value the little things, those little gems that you find throughout the Linux ecosystem, because they're here now, and we ought to appreciate them, we ought to use them, we ought to have fun with them, and yeah, it's going to be part of that tapestry when we look back, and that's really cool. It's not important, it's not ethically vital to remember them or anything like that. It's just cool. It's just a neat part of being a computer geek. Another neat part of being a computer geek is that we can have coffee pretty much anytime we want. I don't know why that has anything to do with being a computer geek, actually. It has nothing to do with being a computer geek. In my case, it has everything to do with being a computer geek who gets to work remotely from home. But right now, that is pretty much anyone listening to this show, I'd wager. So why don't you go get yourself a cup of coffee? We'll come back. We'll talk about GNU Nano. All right, you're back with coffee in hand. That's great to see. Well, of course, I can't see it. This is a podcast. Obviously, I can only hear it. But it's great to hear. We finished up the M section, as I said in the intro. So it's time to move on to the N section. That's N as in Nano. Nano is a text editor by the folks over at GNU. It's got a great website. Honestly, if you go to nano-editor.org, you will be pleased with what you see. It is a slick, useful website. Go there. I highly recommend it, which is interesting because they don't highly recommend Nano. More on that in a moment. So the Nano project itself was started because of a few quote-unquote problems with the wonderfully easy-to-use and friendly Pico, P-I-C-O, text editor. So first and foremost, this is from the README on from the site. So first and foremost was the license, the Pico, or rather the Pine suite, and that's what Pico was, I guess, or from, rather. So Pine was the email application, and Pico was a text editor. But apparently it doesn't use the GPL, and it apparently had unclear restrictions on redistribution. This apparently has changed in recent years, according to this file. It says, before using the Apache license. So that, to me, says that the Pine suite is now Apache licensed. I didn't bother looking into it because I don't use either Pine or Pico and could not be both. But it says, because of this, Pine and Pico were not included in many GNU Linux distributions. Furthermore, some features like go to line number or search and replace were unavailable for a long time or required a command line flag. So it's a little bit clunky. That's what I'm getting from this. Nano sought to improve things by using the GPL, thereby becoming actual free software, capital F, free. Free software, by the way, in case you're not aware of the subtlety between, for instance, the term free software and the term open source. Free software says that you must have the freedom to run the program as you wish for any purpose. You must have the freedom to study how the program works and to change it if you want to. You must have the freedom to redistribute the software, and you must have the freedom to distribute copies of your modified software. It's the four pillars of free software, which isn't necessarily, interestingly, guaranteed with open source software. open source simply says that the source code is available to look at. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can do anything with that code. Free software ensures that you have further freedoms than just being able to see some code, which is nice and important. That's why Nano exists. Furthermore, it emulates the functionality of Pico as closely as reasonable, and of course provides extra functionality. So that's what Nano does. I would say, firmly of two minds about Nano, and I am not by any means going to say that it makes any sense or that it's fair. I'm simply telling you sort of how I experience Nano and all the thoughts that go through my head when I am dealing with Nano or thinking about Nano. So right up front, I don't love Nano. It is not by, I would go so far as to say it was a text editor that I avoid. Now that doesn't mean anything that sounds worse than it actually is. But if you give me the choice between Nano and, say, Jove, certainly Nano or Emacs, then I'm gonna choose Jove or Emacs or Micro Emacs or, you know, something similar in that vein over Nano. Then again, if you made me choose between Vim and Nano, then I would choose Nano. And these aren't judgments that I'm passing upon these text editors. I'm just being honest about what I prefer in a text editor. And it just so happens that I enjoy a good Emacs-like experience over a Vim experience or a Nano experience. That's just where I am right now. And it doesn't mean anything about either of those editors or any other editor. It's just what happens when I sit down and I have to choose an editor to use. That's kind of the thought process, or not even a thought process. It's really just a tendency. Sometimes I inexplicably open up like Kwrite or Kate. No idea why. Don't do it as often as I used to, but I used to kind of think that for some reason Kwrite was sort of the only way to take quick notes, like really quick, fast notes, just a scrap paper. It was Kwrite. I don't know why. Emacs was for serious stuff. Kwrite was for quick jotting down of quick notes. Very strange. Okay, so anyway, habits in front of computers notwithstanding, Nano really, really is not a bad editor. Like, it really isn't. I have used it. I have not hated it. It's just the little things that I don't bother learning on Nano that slow me down. And that's the only reason I don't enjoy it more than I do. Because every time I open it, I look at it, I see that it's by GNU, and I think to myself, it's exactly like Emacs. Not a problem. And it is a problem. It's not anything like Emacs. In fact, one of the common prefix key combinations in Emacs is Control X. Control X on Nano quits. So I'm hitting Control X all the time thinking, well, this is how I open a file, right? Control X, Control F. No, that's how you quit the program. So yeah, it just doesn't work. Cutting a line on Emacs is the same as Nano. What I'm thinking of is searching. Searching for a word in Emacs doesn't work on Nano the same way. I don't even know how you do it on Nano. I think it's Control W in Nano. Yeah, I think it is Control W. So yeah, it's just, there's too many little things, and I don't ever bother learning the correct way to do it in Nano. And so every time I use Nano, I get frustrated. So that's the real reason that I don't like it. But again, I actually do like it. I feel a great sense of relief when I open up, you know, when I'm on an unfamiliar system, I open up a terminal and I think, okay, I have to use an editor. What am I going to use? And I type in Emacs and it's not there. I think, oh no, I'm going to have to use Vim. So then I type in on a Lark Nano and it appears. That is it's the best feeling. And then I close Nano and copy Micro Emacs to the computer. Compile it really quick if I can and then use that instead. But if I can't do that, then I'm back in Nano and it's fine. Here's a cool trick about Nano that you may not know. So in user share Nano, if you've installed Nano in the share directory in /user/share/Nano, or if you've installed this somewhere else, then it'll be, you know, wherever those shared files are with the Nano distribution, are a bunch of Nano RC files. And they have a bunch of different Nano RC files. They've got one for awk. They've got one for grof. You remember grof. We talked about it a couple episodes ago. We've got Java, Lua, what else? Lots and lots of different ones. Oh, shell, something for shell. So these are all syntax highlighting types of files. So if you create a file in your home directory called nanorc, and you can write include / user share nano, for instance, awk.nanorc, close that. And I'm going to type in nano. Actually, I'm not going to type in nano. I'm going to type in nanotest.awk. There we go. And now if I type in awk code, I'll just do, let's do begin, B-E-G-I-N, curly brace. It's highlighting this for me. It's highlighting the keywords. And I'll do, let's just do a printf, I don't know, a string, or that's printf quote percent s / n, and then we'll do comma, and we'll do hello world, close everything, semicolon, close that bracket, and then I'm going to save. So to save in nano, you do it at control O, and that's to write out. So I've just saved that, and then I'm going to do control X, which exits. And now, of course, if I do a awk-f test awk, I get hello world printed to my terminal, just as one would expect. Cool, that's nice. Nano test dot Lua. This should be easy. We'll do a print, quote, parentheses, quote, hello world, close quote, close parentheses, semicolon, write out, exit, and we'll do Lua test, Lua, hello world, there you go. And once again, all the keywords and all of the key symbols are given a color. And that way, if you forget to close a parentheses or a quote, you notice because the color changes. So that's a really, really nice feature that I feel like no one really talks about, is the whole syntax highlighting in Nano. That's pretty useful. And they're already there. I mean, that's what makes it really useful. Obviously, the ability to do that is one thing, but having them included in the distribution of the application, that's pretty nice. Okay, so I'm going to open up a test document again. I guess I'll just do test.txt, boring old plain text. And this application is truly pretty simple. So, I mean, it opens up blank screen with a header across the top and a little menu bar at the bottom. I think in a way the menu bar is a little bit deceptive because I see that menu bar and I think, okay, well, that's all I can do. Those are my only options. So for instance, searching, the word search is not in that menu. There's one control W where is, and that seems a little bit confusing because you're not really used to thinking of, okay, I want to search or find as a whereas. You don't really, that's not something that comes immediately to mind. So I think I skipped over that probably 100 times before I realized that the search function was right there in the menu. It also might not help that it's right next to write out. So I've got get help, write out, where is, cut text, justify, and so on. So write out and where is, I think in my head, they just kind of merged into one thing, and I knew I didn't want to write my file yet. I just wanted to search for some text. And of course, it becomes difficult to do that when you're insisting in your head that it's Control S to search, which is not at all correct. But Control W indeed does search. So I could type in some things, so for instance, penguin, return, and it takes my cursor down to the first occurrence of penguin. Okay, that's pretty neat. Let's see what happens if I search for a word where there are two instances of that word. It takes me to the first instance of penguin, and then I don't have my search function open anymore. But if I do a control W again, then it comes back up with the search function down at the bottom of the screen, but in brackets, it now has the word penguin. So if I just hit return, then it takes me to the next one. Is that the fastest way to scroll through a file containing, I don't know, 33 instances of the word penguin? No. Obviously, you're hitting two keys to advance each time, and that would get rather annoying because it's two keys for the, you know, that ought to cost one in your mind. That's the only way I know to do it, though, and that's certainly the way that they provide in their menu. So I'm going to kind of assume that that's how it's done. Now there is an F6 key if you don't want to do the control key, and that feels like it speeds it up a little bit. So if it's, I think it's F6 to search. So F6 takes me to the first instance, F6 to the second. So it's F6 return, F6 return, F6 return. So but still, it's more key presses than I think you want to do repetitively. So that's the surge. And that's probably one of the things that bugs me the most, is just that sort of that workflow of having to hit the key twice to advance. I want to get in search mode, and then I just want to hit one key to keep advancing through the different instances. It's just me, though. Or it could be just me. I don't really know. You can go page up, page down with Control V or Control Y. I'm assuming a lot of these things are just, you know, they're just things that people sort of are used to from Pico, and that's why they do it that way. For me, I don't know why you... or rather, V and Y would be the keys. Like, V, I get it, it's pointing down, it's also, oh wait, is it? Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it is pointing down. It's on the bottom of a QWERTY keyboard, right? I don't remember where the V is on a QWERTY, yeah, it is, okay. And then Y is at the top of the QWERTY keyboard, so I guess that kind of makes sense. And to be fair, that's the same on Dvorak as well, so control Y and V in terms of, well, this is top row, this is bottom row, it still makes sense on Dvorak. So that's a nice accidental feature, I guess, that, for instance, Vim is not able to provide with its home row, with its focus on the home row. Okay, let's see. So cutting a line, that's an important one for me. I do that a lot, especially since when I write like show notes or an article or really anything that's not formatted. It's in either, I don't know, XML or Markdown or plain text, or I don't really write in plain text. If I was going to do plain text, it would be either Markdown or ASCII doc. But either way, when I do that, I have separate, I put each sentence on a new line. And I do that for version control stuff, because if you do that, then you can diff a file and know exactly what line has been changed and sort of where it has been changed and so on. Whereas if your text file has paragraphs not line delimited, then the diff sees one change to a paragraph as the whole paragraph changing. Even if it's just a misspelled word that you've corrected, it sees the whole paragraph now as a different paragraph. Whereas if you put line breaks between each, after each sentence, then your version control sees that just that one sentence as having changed, which is a lot better. And of course, when you render it out, of course, it eats that line break anyway, so who cares? So cutting lines is something that I do frequently. And the way that you do it in Nano is the same that you do it in Emacs. Control-K. Control-K for cut. It's that simple. What I always forget, though, is that in Emacs, it's Control-Y, but in Nano, it is Control-U to, I guess, uncut, maybe? So that's tricky for me. It's not tricky for everyone. It is tricky for me. And probably tricky for other Emacs users, I guess, if they're not used to Nano. Okay, so another really important one is selecting more than one line. And that is Control-Shift, or Shift-Control if you prefer, and then the number 6, which gives you a selection, or what they call a mark. And once you're in that mode, you're in mark mode, or selection mode, I guess, then you can arrow or Control-P and Control-N for previous line, next line, and you'll see your selection follow your cursor. So I can select a bunch of lines and then cut them with Control-K. And then, of course, we uncut it with Control-U, and you've just moved a big block of lines. So that's huge. It's important. It's very something, again, that I commonly use when working in text files. It is something that I frequently forget on Nano because I don't use Nano enough to remember it, and it is different on Emacs. In fact, strangely, it's so ingrained, I think, in my muscle memory, I'm not sure that I know how to do it. Oh, yes, I do. Control space. I think there's another way, though. I think there's another keyboard combination that I used to use at work because for some reason. Anyway. Control C cancels an active command, so that's kind of like a Control G in Emacs. Control G as in GNU. That's the kind of the panic mode. And then Control O is the writing out, and Control X is quitting, which I've kind of already said. So yeah, that's what those are. That's the basics of Nano. There are lots of other functions though, so. Control G in Nano, unlike in Emacs, takes you to your help menu for Get Help. And this will go through, it lists all of the what I would think of as functions for you. It's one of those things where I think print this out, put it by your computer if you're going to actually learn nano. That would be, I would think that would be the way to go. Like that would, you would have to do that. I mean, if you wanted to get really good and comfortable in nano, that's what you would, I would expect that's what you'd have to do. But here's actually the really great thing about nano. This is why nano should be the default text editor on every Linux distribution out there. I know that's a crazy thing to say from someone who doesn't actually enjoy using Nano. But this is why Nano is so great. You sit down in front of an unfamiliar system, you launch a text editor, and it's Nano. Everything is explained to you on the bottom of the screen. You understand how to use the thing. You understand how to use it at the most rudimentary level. Yes, it might be annoying because you're not very good at it yet, but you know how to use it. Compare that to opening Vim, which has its default mode is not even the mode in which you can type text on the screen. So it's a text editor that when you open it, you are unable to edit text or type text. I mean, technically, you can't edit. That's the point. You're in edit mode, so you can do that, but that just feels weird to me, and I think it would feel weird to a lot of other people. That's not actually to disparage Vim, because I'm about to say the same thing about Emacs. You open up Emacs, and yes, you can start typing right away. That's, you get that, but the commands are completely just foreign to everyone. I mean, the idea that you would need to press two sets of modifier keys before, or two iterations of a modifier before you can do something like open a file, control X, and then control F. Wait, so what? Control XF? No, control X, and then control F. How does that work? It's so confusing to people, you know? I mean, yeah, Emacs has a menu at the top, that's cool. How do you get to that menu if you're just in the terminal, though? That's confusing for people. So there are drawbacks. There are drawbacks to these highly efficient, really amazing text editors that you and I love and live in all day long. That's the editor that we use, it's the editor that we love. Well, they're also very difficult, and they have a learning curve. Nano is simple, and it doesn't really have a learning curve. Whatever learning curve there is written for you at the bottom of the screen. It's really easy to figure that out. Now, you'll only be doing a couple of things. You'll be searching for text, you'll be saving your file, and you'll be exiting. And that's it. That's all you'll know how to do. Well, and editing text, you'll be typing text in. But and that's mostly, you know, for the times that you're going to dip into Nano, that's what you're going to be doing. I'm envisioning the scenario that I find myself in, and you probably find yourself often in as well, dear listener, where you're logging into a server or something, and you realize that, oh, it's time to modify this configuration file for the web server that I've just installed, or whatever. And so you go into whatever text editor that system provides you, and oh, it's Nano. So you search for the option or the configuration option that you need to change, go over the option, add the text, save the file, quit the editor. It happens all the time. We all do it. It happens. And if it's not a server and a web server, then it's a computer and a .rc file of some sort, .bashrc. Or dot profile to change what shell comes up by default, or what your prompt is, whatever, I don't know. Point is, those quick edits, that set of functions, the search, save, and quit, and obviously edit text, that's the core of that text editor. That's what you need to do with as little friction as possible. And Nano puts those options down at the bottom of your screen. It makes it pretty easy to do those things, not the searching, but, you know, close enough, and that's it. That's all you need to do. It's easy. And this is the obvious correct choice. Nano is a very small editor. It is very simple. I don't know that there is a huge contingency of people out there who are really, really familiar with Pico at this point, who just absolutely, you know, we're banking on 80% of the people knowing Nano because they all know Pico. I don't know if that's the situation anymore. It probably was at some point. I don't know that that's the case now. But what we do have now, I think, is at least people logging in and not knowing an editor. Nano is a great my first editor for Linux, and it should be the default. I think Ubuntu was probably one of the first distributions to make that the default editor. I could be making this up. It could be a false memory of mine. But if I recall correctly, Ubuntu was at least at the forefront of saying editor variable is going to be set to Nano, not to Vim. And Good for them. I think that was a great choice to make. And I think a lot of other distributions should do the same thing. Now, I know a lot of people are very, very, very happy with Vim as their default editor. And honestly, I am much happier with Jove or Emacs as my default editor. But I think if you know enough to complain that Nano is the default editor, then you're no longer the target. You're someone who knows the difference between Nano and Vim or Emacs or whatever. Therefore, you are also someone who knows how to change the default. So I think Nano being the default is it's casting a wider net to a lot more users, and it's kind of letting those users in a friendly and inviting way. I think that's important. That's a significant thing. And you have to kind of think back, if you can, because not everyone can, remember the time that a terminal itself was confusing. Like, the idea of computing in a black box with text in it, that was mystifying. Like, how is that computing if there's not a window or a file manager? Like, how is that computing? So if that's confusing, then just imagine now someone says, okay, well, you just need to edit this file. And the command for that is vi space slash etc slash blah dot conf. And you do that, and you're doing it wrong, and you have the spaces wrong, and you have to do it several times, and finally you get it right, and then it opens up into this mysterious text editor, and then they say, oh, and by the way, now you need to go do the Vim tutor so that you can learn how to use this text editor. And so now suddenly you've got this a dependency of, oh, you should have learned this first before trying to do this basic function. And it just keeps going back and back and back. And that's not a friendly experience. That's not a welcoming experience for people. Nano should be the default. Believe me, it pains me to say that, but it's just the truth. It's the logical and sensible truth. Send me email if you disagree. I'm willing to hear your arguments. And I don't think, for the record, I don't think the argument of, well, that's what I had to do to learn, is a valid argument. And I don't think that the argument of, well, in the long run, it's better to learn Vim is a valid argument. I don't think that, well, you should enjoy having to learn Vim or Emacs or whatever. That's not a valid argument. Like, none of these things that presume that other users are exactly on the same track as me or you, those aren't. That's not, again, that's not the target that I think we're aiming for, actually. Because that target, we're quite happy to modify the environment. In fact, modifying the environment is part of the expectation. It's the users who aren't completely sold on this idea yet that we don't want to scare away. And I'm not trying to be too delicate here. I'm not trying to trick people. I'm not trying to bring them in and try to make them believe that Linux is really easy, and that, hey, they should just come into the flock of open source because everything's super easy here. That's not what I'm saying at all. I still think that there's a lot of challenges to be met, even when the default text editor is Nano. But at the same time, I don't think that the kind of what's it called, like a trial by fire or whatever, an initiation ceremony. I don't think that needs to be, now figure out how to use our stupid text editors. That doesn't work for me. That doesn't make sense to me. I think having applications that sort of default to sort of sensible explanations and expectations, I think that's a really strong feature to have. And I think that that's what Nano does for us. As much as you or I may not enjoy using Nano, it's still a darn good application for people who don't necessarily know yet how to use a text editor embedded into a terminal session or a console, a text console. So there you go. Those are my thoughts on Nano. I know they're very controversial, and they're very bold, making lots of bold statements here. In the next episode, we're going to talk about Nano. No, we're not. We just did. We're talk about Normalize and PA Mixer, and maybe a couple other things. We'll see. But those are two good ones, and both audio feature or audio themed. So that's kind of a nice feature. Okay, let's go and have more coffee, but separately. Don't come back this time. This is the end. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. you for listening to the GNU World Order podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, GNUWorldOrder.info and SlackerMedia.info. I will see you next time. Thank you.